All right, it's June 29th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm talking with Donald Hobby, and I wonder if you could start out by just telling us a little bit about your personal background, your educational background, and what led you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
Okay. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, grew up in Wisconsin. Did my undergraduate work at Denison University in Granville, Ohio, in political science, then went on to graduate work in political science at University of Wisconsin-Madison with a PhD in 1957. I then went in the State Department in the Foreign Service for about 3 years. Then I began a teaching career, taught at the University of South Dakota, the University of Denver, got into academic administration as an associate dean at South Dakota, then became dean of arts and sciences, and came to Missoula as academic vice president in 1977 at U of M, and served in that position till 1992 when I retired from full-time work, took a few more years on a post-retirement contract, and then fully retired in the mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm. What made you change from a teaching career to administration?
That's an interesting question, because I had several opportunities to get into administration and thought that I didn't particularly want to do it because I was enjoying teaching and the life of a professor. But I was recruited by a friend who was the dean of the college at South Dakota to become an associate dean, and I discovered that although administration is not necessarily held in high regard on university campuses, that it was a good way to learn things. I was forced to deal with a lot of things I didn't know anything about, and so it really became kind of an educational process for me. Mm-hmm. And it's also a way to have an influence on things. If you get rewards, personal rewards, by helping other people to accomplish their objectives, then administration can be very satisfying, mm-hmm. even though there are a lot of frustrations in it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of stumbled into it and found that I enjoyed it. Their administration isn't always easy, and most people who go into teaching in higher education, I think, prefer the individual autonomy that a faculty member has rather than being so tightly linked to an organization. But that was kind of how I developed.
Mm-hmm. So when you came to the University of Montana, you came in as the academic vice president. So
right.
You were well into administration by then.
Yes.
Having had administrative experiences, and I guess as well as teaching experiences at other universities or institutions, can you describe what it was like at UM when you came in respect to those?
Well, I think a lot of things were similar to the experiences I had before. In other words, the organization of the university, the issues in higher education tend to be the same at a lot of campuses, but each campus, on the other hand, has its own individual situation and unique circumstance. I had come from a background in arts and sciences, been an arts and science dean at South Dakota, and at Montana, the arts and sciences occupy a central place at the university, but at the same time, they're professional schools that have grown up around it, and that's that's what makes sort of the competitor, the contemporary liberal arts public university. And so in that sense, it really wasn't very different. There were certainly some unique aspects and problems in Montana, but I think it's all pretty much cut from the same cloth.
So you mentioned that there are issues in higher education that are pretty common, and then you ended with saying that there were some unique aspects at the UM. Can you sort of review what some of those across-the-board issues are in higher ed from your viewpoint, and also what was unique about the university?
Okay, well, the things that I think are typical or almost perpetual for public universities are, on the one hand, particularly public universities that had developed from the arts and science or liberal arts core, they rely essentially on public funds to function. Traditionally, tuition was not as high as it is now. The whole, that whole balance has now changed. But they're public institutions, but yet they have, particularly in their liberal arts aspects, have some of the characteristics of a private liberal arts college. And it's always an interesting balance to try and recognize that you're a public institution working for the public and having to deal in public ways, but at the same time, an academic institution needs to keep a certain distance from the public in terms of what sentiments are on political issues or economic issues or what have you. The whole, the concept of academic freedom and of diversity and a number of those other things sometimes create a tension between a university and a public. So within the public sector, you're trying to make sure that you respond to your mission to the public and the legislature and the political structure, but at the same time, you need to maintain your autonomy and your educational integrity. It's a little bit different from the role of a private college.
Yeah. Okay, so we were talking about just the commonalities in issues in higher education. How about some of the unique aspects of the University of Montana?
Well, when I came in 1977, the university was really going through a very difficult period. Although it was a time of growth in higher education generally and nationally, U of M's enrollment had actually been falling. And that was probably due to a number of things. But this finally gained the attention of the legislature. And the Board of Regents, and just about the time I arrived, as a result of legislative funding decisions, the university was forced to eliminate the, well, there were various numbers used, but the equivalent of about 40 or 50 or maybe even 60 faculty positions and an equivalent number of staff positions. So,
and sorry, that's in the entire university system?
No, that was at U of M, Missoula.
Wow. Okay.
And that was about a 12 or 13% cut in the personnel area. And it was something that developed over a number of years. Looking at it from hindsight, the university probably didn't take action on this soon enough. It may have lost touch with the political constituencies in the state. Other institutions were growing. The university was not doing as well as it should have in terms of recruiting students, retaining them, taking good care of them when they were here. And so we were losing out. And ultimately, of course, that meant that as other institutions grew and U of M declined, the legislature inevitably said, hey, we're not going to fund you at the levels you used to be funded when you don't have the students.
Mm-hmm.
So that caused, those decisions were basically made before I got here. But one of the things we all got involved in was to then implement those decisions, try and making those cuts and get things back on an even keel so we could get on about our business. But that was a fairly unique situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first time it's happened in Montana, or it's not the first time it's happened at Missoula, but it was a particularly difficult one because the cuts were so so severe.
How was the university failing its students? Why was it that enrollment was dropping here against the national trend?
My perception, and I think you can get different views from different people. Well, there were a number of things. One, that was a time in which, after a kind of strong growth in liberal arts and sort of historic majors, a lot of students migrated to applied fields, business, engineering, what have you. And there was the perception that U of M was just a liberal arts school and didn't have programs that you could make a living with after you got a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And which was an inaccurate perception, but
inaccurate in that you could make a living with those liberal arts degrees,
yeah.
Or there were
both.
Applied fields.
Yeah, they're both.
Right. Okay.
Another problem was that new student services now recruiting. Getting out and telling the story of the university and what a good place it was academically and otherwise was simply not being done.
Mm-hmm.
Our student record system was not adequate.
Mm-hmm.
There was not good management of the class schedule. If a faculty member didn't want to teach at 8 o'clock, they didn't have to teach at 8 o'clock. So decisions about when classes were taught and how many students would be allowed in classes were basically left up to individual faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, that's what you would normally have. But finally, someone has to say, we can't deliver our curriculum unless the students can access it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has to be something more than just the whim of the professor who will say, I'm only going to teach on Tuesday and Thursday and want to do research on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. What about the students who need classes Monday, Wednesday, and Friday? So
mm-hmm.
a whole series of probably small decisions was leading students not to come here, or if they came, they couldn't get into classes. And they couldn't complete their degrees in the time available, and so the attraction to new students was not as strong as it should have been, given the basic quality of the university.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of the university to hold on to students and to really serve them was not up to where it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So, and institutions, I think, from time to time go through this kind of thing where, and not by design, but probably because they drift and don't pay attention. Oh, another thing I was going to mention something that happened at many institutions and certainly happened at U of M. In the period when institutions moved away from in loco parentis to treating students as adults, what had formerly been the dean of men and dean of women and student affairs functions and that kind of thing pretty much disappeared. And just a second here. Okay. So that happened at a lot of schools, but in the attempt to liberate students and to treat them as adults, a lot of the student functions, student support services, were also just disappeared. Mm-hmm. And students were really thrown on their own. So they weren't, the advising system tended to break down, was weakened. There wasn't much done for students in terms of personal counseling. For students who came inadequately prepared, there wasn't much remedial service. So one of the things that became necessary, without going back to the old days of the dean of men and dean of women, was to build back student services in a way that could really help students succeed. Mm-hmm. And I think most institutions have learned that lesson, that you can't just walk away and say, well, that's your problem, mm-hmm. figure it out. So there were a whole series of things that needed to be done, but and they couldn't be done overnight because one of the dilemmas when you're in a posture of cutting back, as we were in 1977 and 78, was you end up probably cutting things that you shouldn't cut, or but just because of the budget realities mm-hmm. of the situation. So that was a difficult period. It took a number of years to turn that around, but I think little by little, the institution, through the work of a lot of people, was able to right itself and serve students better and start to build enrollment back up. And got out of what was clearly a difficult time, but it was hard.
So I want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You said that one of the things about being in administration that was new to you but common to administration is that you're not always well received on campus. And so I suspect coming to UM at a difficult time like that, that could well be the case, or could be exaggerated even. Tensions perhaps high on campus with people being cut. Describe a little bit about the relationship between administration and the rest of campus at the time.
Okay.
Administration and yeah. students, administration and faculty, the president's role, the president's the perception of the president.
Well, it was very hard, and inevitably in a period like that where some difficult decisions have to be made, decisions really that nobody wants to make, there is a temptation to say, well, we really don't need to make those decisions, or let's just see if we can get more money from the legislature, or that kind of thing. There had been a faculty, or a group representing the faculty, or some of the faculty on campus for years that wanted to go for collective bargaining. And there had been various attempts to do that, and finally during this period, and I think it was 1970, late 77 or early 78, the enough faculty members voted for collective bargaining that what that was then the University Teachers Union became the bargaining agent for the faculty. And so that was one of the consequences, was the faculty voted for collective bargaining. Believing, I think, that they couldn't trust the traditional mechanisms, and that they needed to take care of their own interests through some group that represented themselves, which was, I think looking back on it, was probably understandable. Mm-hmm. But more directly to your question about relationships, they were difficult. Because given the funding and the decisions of the Board of Regents and the way the funding system worked, you basically couldn't just say, well, we're not going to make any cuts, because we didn't have the budget. The budget decisions had already been made. So in those circumstances, the administration is forced into making tough and often unpopular decisions. Mm-hmm. And you can explain, you can communicate, you can try and make people understand, but oftentimes there's a tendency to believe that, well, you know, if you could just do this or you could do that, maybe we wouldn't have to do this. There's a kind of denial, mm-hmm. that is, and I think that was stronger among the faculty probably than the students. But students don't like to see people lose their jobs, and you tend to create a situation, if you get into that situation, you tend to create a situation where people get pitted against each other. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why you try and avoid getting into it if you at all cost, and try and prevent it from ever happening, because if it happens, then you have to take fairly severe actions, mm-hmm. to deal with the situation. But so we faced that for a number of years, but we're able to, after about a year and a half of negotiations, conclude a collective bargaining agreement with the faculty that dealt with issues of salary and working conditions and that kind of thing. And little by little, we're able to build back the resources where we needed them. Mm-hmm. Another problem that really exacerbated things was that a number of the areas of the university were growing. Other areas were in a state of decline in terms of student interest. But because of this really inattention to this problem over a number of years, you could end up with a department or a school or program that was totally tenured faculty. Lots of faculty, not many students. And over in, you know, business or pharmacy or someplace else, lots of students, but not enough faculty. Mm-hmm. And if you could simply convert the philosopher faculty into a pharmacist, why, that would be wonderful, but it doesn't work that way. And so you making changes to adapt the organization or the university to enrollment trends and that kind of thing has to come fairly slowly, mm-hmm. and incrementally. But over the years, it did finally happen.
Now, I've heard the university at times be referred to as a graveyard for presidents, and you certainly outlasted quite a few of them, or a number of them. How was the president's role, or how did the president's role fit in this? How did it affect the president at the time? mean, that's a volatile situation. Yes. To be guiding.
Right. I worked for four different presidents, mm-hmm. Richard Bowers, Neil Bucklew, Jim Cook, and George Denison. And it is true until, I guess, until President Denison's tenure, the typical life of a president at the University of Montana was not very long. Although, again, that's not particularly unique to U of M.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of President Bowers, who was president when I was hired, he went through, I think, the most difficult period, and finally, basically he resigned, but he was really strongly encouraged and forced to resign by the Board of Regents. As probably an outcome from all of this turmoil in the late 70s,
mm-hmm.
President Bucklew was here for, I guess, what, 4 or 5 years, something like that. He was certainly not under pressure to resign, but when an opportunity to go to a larger, you know, more prestigious university, the University of West Virginia, which was his home, why, he was happy to take it. There is a, for most presidents, I think there's a period when they can be effective and initiate new measures and develop support. But if the environment is adverse or a number of difficult decisions are made, there's a tendency to focus the blame or responsibility on the person at the head of the organization, which is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's it's certainly the same thing in the corporate world or the military world or what have you. So if it's not probably not unusual that there's a turnover in presidencies typically.
By the same token, when we blame or place the blame on the head of an organization, we also often characterize an organization by its head. You know, you have the Bowers years, the Bucklew years.
Right.
How were those characteristically different?
Well, different personalities, different individuals. I would almost say that, although there were differences, and I think different levels of success, but the issues, in many respects, were about the same.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take one for an example. How do you create a better sense of constituency among the public of Montana for a university like this? It's more difficult for the liberal arts university than land-grant institution, particularly in an agricultural state like Montana. The advantage, I'm talking about Montana State, the advantage of the land-grant institution with co-op extension and with the experiment station and all of the other things, there's a kind of built-in constituency for the university. Now, land-grant institutions have gone way beyond serving farmers and offering home economics and doing experiments for agriculture. I mean, they've become much more complex institutions, but they have natural constituencies. The liberal arts universities, the ones that have the law school or fine arts, arts and sciences, journalism, what have you, it's a more difficult task. So one of the things I learned when I first came here was the efforts being made to try and weld a better tie and a better understanding between the public and the university. And that was something Richard Bowers really began with the Excellence Fund through the U of M Foundation to raise private money to provide a margin of excellence for things that probably weren't going to be supported by the state. But every president since then, President Buckley, President Cook, President Dennison, have built on that. It's not the same thing, but many of those ventures and efforts were really not started yesterday, but have been developed and have been improved and have been made more successful and have come to fruition. But the issue of trying to making sure that you're a statewide institution, there's a lot of regionalism in Montana. There's a lot of geography to be covered. You can't be just the University of Western Montana. You've got to be the university for the entire state, and in fact, even hopefully have some sort of profile regionally and nationally. So you've got to be out in the state convincing the people of the state and the elites of the state that you really are their state university. Mm-hmm. And if they're more comfortable with the other university, if that seems more down home to them, if that seems more authentically Montana, then you have to work doubly hard to convince them that it's important that your university is really part of their responsibility too. Mm-hmm. Not just in terms of student recruitment, but what you can do and public service and research efforts and all the rest of it. So that inevitably becomes the agenda of any president, part of the agenda, is to get out among the public, among the political elites, and to convince these people that this is their university and it's something very important and they need to treasure it and to enhance it. So, you know, I think different presidents were successful at different levels on this, but the issues and the efforts have been pretty much along the same line. Mm-hmm.
So I want to switch gears a little bit. We've been talking about sort of large concepts of the university as a whole. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the very specific nature of your job as academic vice president, and especially you mentioned that one thing you liked about administration was being able to have a very direct influence on people and on their jobs, ability to do their job. So in the context of talking about your specific job, talk about how you influence people, the university, how you try to guide things through your decisions, your work.
Well, as academic vice president, or later provost, you're probably responsible for more than two-thirds of the personnel in the university and probably close to two-thirds of the budget, roughly. So in a sense, you're the vice president that's basically supposedly responsible for delivering the most fundamental function of the institution. That's not to demean the other areas, but they're really support areas. Business and finance, student services, all the other things that come along. So, in an academic organization, the basic academic work of the institution is done by faculty members and departments and schools. And it is not like a corporate organization in which decisions are made in Main Hall or centrally and then handed down to faculty members. Teaching at the higher education level is a profession, so you're dealing with people who are professionals, and in to an extraordinary extent have an opportunity to kind of define their careers and how they want to, what they want to emphasize and what they want to do and how they want to teach. That's really left up to them. They have a great deal of autonomy, and I think that's the one of the great strengths of American higher education, is it's built on that principle. But so it's very important to recruit and retain and promote and reward people who are of high quality and who will use that professional opportunity and autonomy to the best. And I think the vast majority of faculty members do that. They don't need to be told what to do. They don't have to go into their supervisor, who will sit down and give them the week schedule. They know, they should know what to do and they should want to do. Sometimes there'll be differences of opinion about whether one function is more important than others, or whether your class load should be 12 hours or 14, or how much time you should be giving off of research or something like that. But you know, the basic obligations and the understanding of the role has to well up from the bottom, from the faculty. And that's where the work of the institution is done. And whether it's, whether a unit is organized as a separate school or a department such as history or in the library, a great deal of respect and deference has to be extended to the professional autonomy of the people who are doing the work. At the same time, that doesn't mean you just tell everybody, well, you just do whatever you want to and we think this will work out pretty well. That probably is what happened at the university during the early 70s. It does make a difference if students can't get into classes. Mm-hmm. A department chair or a dean or somebody will finally have to sit down and say, if everybody says, I only want to teach two classes and I only want to teach on Tuesday and Thursday, and I like small classes, so I'm not going to allow more than 10 students in my class, we're not going to get the job of the history department done. You know, we're probably not going to get much research done, and we're probably not going to serve our students. So somebody has to say, look, there are limits here, and we've got to work this out collegially and collectively. So my approach, as much as possible, was to work off the understanding that the basic work is done at the unit levels, but that you needed to, you had a decentralized organization, you needed to try and set some general guidelines and parameters centrally, and then to develop deans and department chairs and faculty members who could operate within this environment with some generally understood guidelines and rules, but with some belief that they had their responsibility on autonomy to be used in a professional level, and that they could be rewarded within that structure. It's not an easy act, but it means from time to time you'll have to lay down the law at the central level, if for no other reason than maybe somebody higher than you laid it down, like the Board of Regents, which really has the ultimate power. I mean, there's a real paradox, because on the one hand, a great deal of the authority and power of the university, most of it, is really focused at at the faculty level. And that the faculty assumes that it is the most important group in the university, and sometimes the faculty would say, we are the university. I mean, they... And in a sense, that's true. On the other hand, if you look at the formal authority in a public university, it's really focused in the Board of Regents, which is the governing body, which has the full power, autonomy, control, what have you. Mm-hmm. So you have a formal system that says, here's this board, managing board, which even has sort of it's a constitutional board and therefore has powers beyond the legislature to govern higher education. So it's responsible for everything. But that's a public lay board. But then the real authority and work of the university is done in a very decentralized and fashion, sort of distance from the Board of Regents, which meets, you know, 10 or 12 times a year. So operating in that environment where there's quite a distance between the formal authority of the organization and the realistic way in which things get done, administrators, I think particularly central administrators, have to develop, decide which are the important questions and try and focus on those, and then create systems of incentives and maybe penalties, but more in mostly incentives, to develop positions within the organization at what you would normally think of as subordinate levels, but at deans, department chairs, directors, etc., where people exercise a lot of authority and responsibility. And it's fascinating because a lot of this has to be done through persuasion and consultation and consensus. You could sit at the center and write a memo and say, this is what we're going to do, but if the faculty really doesn't want to do it or they don't believe that it's a good idea, they have tremendous power to see that it won't happen. So, I mean, and that's true in any organization, but it's certainly true in higher education. Mm-hmm. So, it's a very interesting, challenging organizational environment.
So we've been focusing on this really transitionary time in the university, and one of the elements of that transition, as you just mentioned, is going from what you perceived as maybe faculty having a little too much autonomy to the detriment of the students.
Well, it was just... It wasn't... I wouldn't characterize it as faculty having too much autonomy. It was that the institution was not paying attention mm-hmm. to what its responsibilities were.
Okay.
And so, too much was being lost.
Mm-hmm. So you have that transition of the university right. trying to pay more attention, do a better job by the students. At the same time, you have the collective bargaining of the faculty taking place. Who were some of the key players, both faculty and administration, during that time? Names that stand out to you? Either, you know, promoting those changes, at the head of them, or opponents to them?
Well, in turn, I think the negotiation of the first collective bargaining contract with the faculty was a key development, because that contract covered a whole series of things. It wasn't just salaries and wages. It was academic freedom. It was academic responsibility. It dealt with the faculty evaluation system. You know, the authority of department chairs, and so it was a comprehensive contract, and it was a beneficial contract in the sense that a lot of things that were either just sort of understood or maybe not understood but had been done differently by different sections of the university were pulled together and were finally cleared up, and there was this contract that bound both the faculty and the regents in the administration that said, this is the way we're going to do this, or this is the way we're going to do this. And that was very helpful. I think the faculty put together a good bargaining team. They were headed up by Ron Perrin, who was a professor in philosophy and then later made the transition to political science, who on the one hand was a very effective spokesman for the faculty, but I think on the other hand was able to see larger issues. One of the key one of the key aspects of bargaining, when collective bargaining came, given the law of collective bargaining in Montana for public employees, the faculty discovered that it was really bargaining with the Board of Regents, not with the campus administration. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at the contract, it's between the... And I mean, that had some potential, but it also had some perils in it, because the regents took the view that since they were bargaining on different campuses, that they wanted the collective bargaining coordinated out of the commissioner's office. It's understandable. And they were attempting to achieve approximately the same kinds of goals through their various collective bargaining contracts on campuses. But not all of the institutions are the same in the Montana University system, and what might go down well at Western or Northern was not necessarily what the University of Montana wanted, either faculty or administration. So one of the dilemmas that we had on the... I was a member of the administration team. It was not the spokesman. The spokesman came from the commissioner's office. But there were really two levels of negotiation. I mean, one was the campus people negotiating with the commissioner staff and the board in terms of what the regent's position would be on some of these issues. And then there was, of course, the bargaining between the two sides. So it wasn't really two sides. I mean, it was much more complex mm-hmm. than that. And I think if you probably talked to Ron Perrin, he would tell you the same thing from the faculty point of view, because there are lots of different constituencies within the faculty. I mean, some faculty I know, well, just to give you an example of an issue close to home for you, did the librarians really belong within the bargaining unit as a member of the faculty? And library faculty felt very strongly that they were part of the faculty. I mean, there's no doubt in their mind. And that, in fact, that's the way they were placed in the bargaining unit. There were a number of faculty, I shouldn't say many, but there were a number of faculty who felt the librarians were really not faculty. Mm-hmm. they did such different things and they couldn't be treated and measured in the same way that they didn't care much about library faculty. So library faculty, as they would articulate their issues through their bargaining council to the UTU, might find that they had a whole set of issues with regular teaching faculty. So those would be the kind of internal things that would go on. But after about, I think, a year, with some difficult moments really on both sides and the potential for a strike and a lot of other things, there was a agreement that was negotiated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't perfect, but it resolved enough of these issues that sort of moved on. But, you know, before the, let me give you one example of, when you said we'd gone too far and towards faculty autonomy, I don't think it was faculty autonomy, it was just a chaotic approach to decision making. So, for example, if one of the issues when a faculty member would come from another school to U of M, you would say, well, how much prior service credit are you going to be given toward tenure? Which would, and the regents had a policy, or at least they thought they had a policy, that you would give a maximum of, say, 3 years prior credit or four or whatever it was. But we had deans, this is prior to collective bargaining, who would give people more than that. Mm-hmm. And they would write them a letter. And the letter would say, I hereby give you 5 years of prior service credit. Mm-hmm. Well, they had clearly gone beyond their authority. But if you're a faculty member coming here and you rely on a representation like that, you've probably got a contract. Because it was reasonable for you to believe that that dean had the authority to do what he offered you. So it wasn't just an issue of faculty autonomy, it was sort of cleaning up the administration and getting everybody on the same page and mm-hmm. say, look, here are the things, this is the way we do these things, and you can't just run off and do them. It isn't every man for himself here. So that's kind of a minor detail, mm-hmm. but the collective bargaining contract, although it tended to address a lot of issues, I think there was a feeling on both sides that a lot of those things needed to be addressed.
So we've talked a lot about this period in the right. university.
Yeah.
Just smooth sailing after that?
This no.
was the big upheaval
no.
and then
no.
you just rode on out the next
no.
15 years?
No. No.
How about some events from you know, the later 80s into the 90s? You know, that's the early years of George Denison, who has remained at the helm for nearly as long as any other president.
Right. Let me touch on one thing. One of the things that was put into the collective bargaining contract and was a clause on retrenchment. When the cuts were made in 1977 and 78, as I indicated to you, it was an accumulation of a problem that had gone on for long enough, so you're going to end up doing stuff that you didn't want to do, but you just had to because you didn't have enough money to keep paying all the people that were around. So some people who were doing who were worthy, doing good jobs, were needed, were going to lose their jobs because they weren't tenured or, you know, didn't have job protection, and the institution had to cut back. So one of the most difficult clauses that was negotiated in that first collective bargaining contract was retrenchment. And trying to define the circumstances under which, if an institution faced a fiscal exigency or emergency, how would you make cuts, and what would the system be to do that? Recognizing that if you use the normal routine, which is just to take those people who are vulnerable, that you may well cut in exactly the wrong areas. I mean, if, again, hypothetically, if business is growing and music is declining, and your entire music faculty is tenured, so they have a right to serve until whenever, and you need more faculty in the business area, and you have to cut back, most of the business faculty that you have are probably non-tenured because they were hired recently. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the main things that retrenchment would allow you then to say, well, in a hypothetical sense, we have this program in XYZ, and we have 15 tenured faculty members there, and we have no students. So we want to take those resources and move them from there over to where they're really needed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how do you do that? And so it's a kind of worst case scenario. I mean, again, the best advice is not to get into that position in the first place. But retrenchment was an attempt to sort of address that issue. And as President Bucklew left, the university was beginning to find itself. I mean, we started to make recoveries, but we still had these situations where we were overstaffed in certain areas, couldn't reposition the resources. You were just sort of being strangled. And the when President Bucklew left, he did not invoke retrenchment, but he left a plan sort of on the way out the door that suggested that the university might well have to drop some academic programs, including communication sciences and disorders and religious studies and several others. That report was extremely controversial. It was not implemented, but it, you know, it was kind of a harbinger of things to come, because later on, then toward the end of the President Cook administration, this problem of an inability to respond to needs and an inability to, other than waiting for people to die, of getting out, it sort of, do you bleed the organization to death by 1,000 cuts, or do you make some specific cuts in certain areas and try and come out of it better? And either process is very traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
But that led to the retrenchment process that was actually invoked and was finally accomplished with the loss of finally home economics as a program and business education and religious studies was recast and communication sciences and disorders. And the decisions that finally came out were not the ones that were originally proposed, but that was the first time it was actually, there was an implementation of retrenchment. Again, very difficult, very controversial. I served for four different presidents. I was acting president three times, once between the departure of Dick Bowers and the arrival of Neil Buckley. That was for about 4 months. Then between President Buckley and President Cook, that was another, I guess, 4 or 5 months. And then, no, that was longer. That was about 6 or 7 months, I guess. And then from President Cook to President Dennison. And about the time President Dennison came, we had just finally gone through that other cutback. In fact, I had been working over in the commissioner's office for a year when that finally was implemented. I was not on campus when it was implemented. But President Dennison's view was that he would not have made those cuts, and that certainly can be argued. You could say, well, if you wouldn't make those cuts, then you would have to say, well, you know, how would, assuming you had the same budget situation, where would you rather have those cuts, or where would you do them? Yeah, I think in President Cook's defense or view, the university had made cuts in the traditional way to the point where you just couldn't do that anymore. And so you had to take a different approach, and that's what finally, I think, stimulated him to invoke retrenchment. Not that he wanted to, but he felt that for the overall good of the entire university, it was debilitating to do it the other way, and so it was better to do targeted, focused cuts. President Dennison's attitude, I think, has been, we shouldn't do those things at all. What we should do is have a growing, flourishing university that doesn't cut programs but basically adds them and becomes a more complete institution, and has been fairly successful in that effort. It has helped that this has been a period of enrollment growth. And I think part of that is due to paying attention to things like student services and getting students into class and giving them attention when they're here and trying to do good retention work and get the public sector to understand what the university is all about, bringing more federal money, etc. But this has been a period of enrollment growth. My guess is that we're probably looking now at a period of enrollment stability or decline, if you look at the high school demographics. And one of the antidotes to that has been the notion, well, you'll recruit more out-of-state students because they pay full fare, maybe more than full fare. But the competition for non-resident students among institutions, both public and private, is just phenomenal. It's almost like going out and buying football players. I mean, you end up discounting your tuition or giving them scholarships to come here, so you don't get the revenue that you might So the solution to avoiding retrenchment or avoiding cutbacks is, of course, to have a growing enrollment base and a funding base. And certainly that has gone on since 1991, when President Dennison has come. in the long run, it probably doesn't totally avoid the problem. I mean, if you can grow the university and then stabilize the enrollment, and if you're not subject to these demographic trends and that kind of thing, you probably don't have to deal with those kinds of issues. But, you know, if the demography of the state is such that the high school population declines, it's pretty hard to avoid demography.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of preempted my last question there, which was you're still a Missoula resident and keep up on the university. I was going to ask to give your view of the current situation and perhaps future of the university, which you've done. So I guess I'd just have you offer any other words you have on your time at the university.
Okay. Well, I feel very fortunate to have worked at the university. It was challenging. It was a good institution. Later on in my career, I did a lot of accrediting work for the Northwest Association. Did a lot of accrediting visits, chaired a lot of teams, etc. And so got to know a lot about what other schools was doing. But became more and more convinced that the University of Montana is an institution that really outperforms its resource base. I mean, if you look at this in terms of how much is being put into the institution in terms of salary dollars and supplies and scholarship support and that kind of thing, sort of inputs, outputs. If you look at how much you're putting in and how much you're getting out, U of M is an incredible institution.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the input indicators, and that's what people in higher education tend to look at, you know, how well is the faculty paid, how large and small are the classes, how well is the library supported, these are all sort of input indicators. But then the question becomes, what comes out of this in terms of the students, and what comes out in terms of the graduates and the record? And that is what is truly remarkable and amazing about the University of Montana. Because if you look at the input levels, they're not the worst in the United States, but they're typically nowhere close to the middle. You know, they're Montana's rankings. And it's not just higher education. It's teacher salaries in the public schools. It's
Montana tends to claim those lower ranks amongst the states.
Right.
Doesn't it?
So then you would say, well, how can they do what they do? And this has been a characteristic, I think, of U of M for many, many years. I don't know if you've read Harold Merriam's history of the university.
I have.
And it's an interesting book because he he sort of breaks it up into the years of the, I mean, each chapter is a presidency.
Right.
But he was a faculty member who strongly believed that, you know, that the president's chief responsibility was really to do what the faculty wanted him to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Harold Merriam was a tremendous faculty member here, but was a leader of the faculty in urging the Board of Regents and presidents to basically respect and honor the faculty and run the institution the way they wanted it run. And some presidents did that and some others didn't.
Right.
There are quite a few in Marion's book that didn't really measure up to his view. But,
and he was not shy about saying so.
No. And many times the faculty view is absolutely sound and right. But sometimes faculty members, as intelligent and as sophisticated as they are, they tend to know really very little about the larger university. They're so immersed in their own area. And so to try and educate them about the larger picture or what the context in the state is or anything like that is often a challenging task. But these issues of the tension between an intellectually stimulating and free university and the political environment around it, you get that every time in the Marion book.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of adequate resources or political intervention or that kind of thing recur frequently. Not frequently, but regularly. And just about the time that things are stabilized and everything seems to be on a strong course, then something happens and there's another controversy or another. I mean, there's almost a rhythm to this. So
right.
I've had a number of interesting discussions with President Dennison about this, and his, to his credit, I think he has said, he's insisted that the university can be better and bigger and larger and more of a national university than we are, and we certainly are now compared to, 10 years ago. But so that kind of vision and that kind of impetus for a larger, stronger vision is a very healthy kind of force within the institution to move it forward. On the other hand, you always need to be aware of these forces that you can't control. One would be demography right now. I mean, if you look at the high school graduating classes and some of these other things, or the need to grapple with simply raising tuition and excluding more and more students from an education because of the financial hazards of, or the cost of attending and that kind of thing. So there are always these sort of mitigating factors that any president or anybody would have to pay attention to. And they're I think, right, if you look at the future of higher education right now, both nationally and even in Montana, there's a lot of reason for optimism in terms of what has been accomplished. And I think the University of Montana and Montana State University both are just institutions that are remarkably stronger than you would expect to find,
mm-hmm.
given the resources in this state.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always a level of peril in that, and the financial tendencies of higher education now to cost more and more and more to place more and more students in a position of extraordinary debt. And state legislatures being less and less willing to appropriate at the levels mm-hmm. that they used to. I don't think it's a distrust or hatred of higher education. It's because other priorities like corrections and social services and those other things have just become huge healthcare have become huge responsibilities of state government. So higher education isn't being picked on, but it's just, it can't get the resources that it once did. And then the federal government is sort of looming on the outside, and there are more and more pieces of evidence that there's a kind of disquiet about whether higher education is really doing what it says it's doing. Mm-hmm. It almost reminds me of the concern that has developed appropriately about our public school systems. Are the graduates of schools really being educated? What about the students who are dropping out? What about the students who get degrees and supposedly are qualified, but can't write and can't read and can't do even simple math and are not qualified to do anything, but yet they have a baccalaureate degree from not just a trade school someplace, but a supposedly, you know, accredited, reputable public institution. And so there's an increasing level of disquiet about the cost of higher education, about whether institutions are spending too much money on things that maybe are nice but are not necessarily essential to higher education. I mean, the easy targets would be football or those kinds of things, but even how much the state should support research or graduate education. How many graduate PhDs in history do we need in the United States? Given the market for historians and that kind of thing. And the fact that maybe is, in the case of the public schools, although they're one of our most treasured assets, they're really not performing up to the level that we need as a nation to be competitive. I think there's a growing concern that maybe higher education is in the same boat. That it makes a lot of claims, it makes a lot of statements about what it is doing, and in some cases it does those things, but in some cases it really doesn't. And what are we going to do about it? And higher education, unlike the public school system, has always operated in a system of self-governance autonomy, where if there's a quality control mechanism there, it's probably the accrediting system in the United States, which is not really a system. It's a kind of crazy quilt pattern. But it's worked pretty well. But the essence of that system is self-regulation. And what's happening now, I think, is that, and I saw this in the accreditation business, a lot of stuff that used to be taken on faith, that we're doing a good job and you can trust us to do a good job, and we don't want federal intervention or state intervention or outside intervention. We know what we're doing. Trust us. And incidentally, we need more money. That attitude, I think, formulation is less and less effective now. As you know, business leaders, there's a President Bush has, or I guess it's the Secretary of Education, has created this commission that's about to come out with a report on higher education. I just read a thing in the New York Times a couple days ago about there's a staff version of their report, which may or may not be changed, but it's very critical of higher education. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that most higher education leaders will decry this report and say, you know, it's completely off base. But
politically motivated.
Yeah, and it may well be. But there are enough danger signals out there to suggest that all institutions, including the University of Montana, may have to go through a period where they are sort of refocused. And the way most institutions have grown in the United States is through a period of a process of imitation. I mean, if you were a teacher's college, you wanted to become a state university or state college, a regional college or university. If you're a regional college or university, you want to become a national university. You wanted to have a graduate program, and you know, everybody was going to ultimately be a complete multi-university. Mm-hmm. It's probably not a realistic dream or system, and so some institutions are probably going to need to make some choices about what they can do and do well and focus on that rather than trying to be everything to everybody. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's necessarily around the corner tomorrow, but I'm sure it's an issue that will face us in Montana. Mm-hmm. Because it periodically has. Mm-hmm. And there have been attempts, you know, just as U of M grappled with retrenchment, maybe well, maybe poorly. There have been attempts to close institutions in Montana. Usually were abortive. And not so much on educational grounds, but on political and cultural and regional grounds. I mean, Mike Mansfield, for whom your institution is named, great American, great graduate of the University of Montana, etc. When the Board of Regents had a Blue Ribbon Commission here in the 1970s and was about to close Montana Tech, Mansfield and some other people almost single-handedly turned that around. Mm-hmm. Just because of Butte and a number of other issues. And that's happened before, and it probably would happen again. The restructuring of the university system, the system we now operate under, is supposed to sort of achieve some efficiencies and economies by putting all of the institutions either under MSU or U of M. And I think it's had some benefits. But, you know, unless you get at the real cost issues on a campus, and if a Western or a Northern, even with the subsidies that U of M, Missoula, and MSU Bozeman are giving those two campuses, just are not economically viable because lack of population and lack of, what do you finally do? Mm-hmm. And again, as long as the demographics are okay and there are enough students to go around, it's probably going to be okay. But if you have a declining age pool, what do you do about that? Mm-hmm. So I expect it'll be a period of challenge for anybody who's around. Any other questions?
No, I think that's about it. I appreciate your time.
Okay.
And your insight. Thanks for talking with me.
Okay, I was happy to talk to you, David.